Prime Time replay from Money FM 89.3.
We're joined live on the phone. Brock Silva's joining us all the way from Shanghai. This is Voice from China. We turn our attention to MIT, or the prestigious Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is cutting future research collaboration with Chinese tech giants Huawei and ZTE, all citing U.S. investigations into the company's alleged sanctions violations. The announcement follows similar moves by Stanford University, University of California's flagship Berkeley, and University of Minnesota, which have all cut future research collaboration with Huawei. MIT has been under fire in recent months as it faces a global U.S. campaign to blacklist Huawei over espionage fears. Brock, how significant will this move, MIT saying it's cutting future research, how significant will this be in affecting MIT's funding support in future?
You know, as you mentioned, it's not just MIT. It's MIT plus a whole host of very prominent U.S. universities. Even sort of Oxford in the U.K. is on board. So we can bet that others are going to follow. Now, it seems reasonable to me, if your home government thinks that Huawei is a risk, you probably shouldn't do joint research with Huawei. China will not like this, as U.S. research capabilities are generally much higher than those in China. And you know what? The U.S. universities probably won't like it either, as they're going to have to give up what is likely a nice revenue stream. You know, notice that MIT has given up future projects, but not current ones. Is Huawei somehow less of a risk today than it will be tomorrow? No, it's just that that money has already been spent. But look, nonetheless, MIT and Oxford and their brethren are very wealthy, and they're going to survive, even if this has a knock-on effect for other projects from other countries, like Russia or perhaps Saudi Arabia.
In an attempt to strengthen the vetting of our research partners, how would MIT's efforts potentially affect its relationships with other entities in China, Hong Kong, Russia, and as you mentioned, Saudi Arabia?
Well, peer-to-peer relationships are certainly going to be strained because those overseas countries no longer have full confidence that they can that they'll be able to enact their policies in coordination with these U.S. universities. So I guarantee that those joint efforts and those labs will not be fun places to work, but I think this will all get straightened out before too long.
Okay, Brock, let's move to South Korea now, which has just launched its 5G wireless services this week, allowing it to set the standards and capture sales in a global 5G services market expected to grow to $123 billion by 2025. Just how will this kickoff give South Korea the lead in the tech race when it comes to comparisons between U.S. and China? And how long do you think South Korea can maintain a lead?
Well, look, South Korea is clearly getting a nice jump on everyone else. Although in the U.S., you know, Verizon is also scheduled to go live with 5G this week. So South Korea didn't win the race by that much. But the South Korea tech sector is formidable, and it's going to be fascinating to see how much 5G potential they can really unlock. All we know at this point is that I think the world will benefit from a healthy 5G competition between South Korea and the U.S. My personal view as a prediction, I'd be surprised if in 3 years South Korea was still in the global lead. And of course, once we see some standards set, at that point, Singapore is going to jump in and be the envy of the world.
Okay. Well, Bro, what does being the first country to have 5G wireless networks mean for South Korea, other than bragging rights?
It certainly is. It represents some economic promise for sure. Now, by getting in first with a small sample size, they should be able to do it at a relatively low initial cost. But, you know, over time, that scale becomes more and more important, and it's over time that countries with large scales like the U.S. are going to have an advantage. So it should be an advantage for South Korea. It should bring real economic benefits, The real question is how long they'll be able to maintain that lead, given that their market is not as large as some of their competitors.
You're listening to Brock Silvers there, Kaiyun Capital's Managing Director. This is Voice from China, where we check in with all that's trending in that part of the world. If we move on, Brock, the U.S. has said it will not send high-level officials to attend China's second Belt and Road Summit in Beijing this month, raising worries about the project's financing practices. Do you think this reflects a hard stance that the U.S. has towards China, and that unless China makes changes to financing, governance, acceptance for international norms and standards, and its call for transparency, that this is just going to continue?
Look, the hard line from the U.S. certainly doesn't help these matters, but I think the underlying issue here is probably Belt and Road itself, which is really kind of a series of deals between China and local countries. And my guess is the U.S. isn't sending a high-level delegation because it doesn't see a lot of potential upside being at the conference. I'm just not sure there's a huge BRI role for the U.S., except perhaps in countering BRI with its own local projects. That idea hasn't really taken root yet, but I think it could make a great deal of sense.
Okay, Brock, maybe you can talk us through. I mean, why is China struggling to ease Western concerns over debt, transparency, and Chinese influence with regards to President Xi Jinping's plan to build a new Silk Road as it prepares for a major summit in late April?
Well, China's working hard to do this, but look, it struggles to ease these worries because BRI isn't quite as it's been presented. You know, it was presented as a business model, and yet it doesn't make a lot of business sense. The underlying projects, I think, still show questionable economics. Many of the projects go forward because China's willing to give favorable financing. Of course, in exchange for that, China gets to use Chinese labor and suppliers and achieve certain military and strategic goals. The generally poorer countries on the receiving end are often happy to get these loans. But unprofitable projects won't end well, mark my words, and we may see some significant regrets one day. I think Malaysia did a brave thing in canceling its BRI projects recently, and I think the rest of the world is still just a bit uneasy.
Now, China's gained a major victory after it convinced Italy to become the first G7 nation to formally sign on to its Belt and Road plan. Some other Western countries less inclined to do so, despite many keeping an open mind. Can you share with us your thoughts on why the Italian government is perhaps willing to take on this risk, despite sparking tensions potentially between the EU and the U.S.?
Look, a lot of American opinion is also in search of an answer for this question. It baffles the American side a bit as to why Italy went ahead and did this, but Italy has its own economic worries, and perhaps it sees the same enticements that some of the Asian countries did, and would like to access some of that financing and some of those projects. We couldn't completely blame them if that were the driving factor. But as I said, America's also baffled by Italy's willingness to participate.
Well, Brock, the U.S. Chamber's head of international affairs, Myron Brillion, said it's unlikely that China would agree to an enforcement mechanism that included reimposition of unilateral U.S. tariffs without the current tariffs being removed. Why is the U.S. still knowingly suggesting this mechanism?
Right. You know, I think Mr. Brilliant is indeed brilliant and that China is not going to like this proposal at all. And China may well not agree to it in the end, but that doesn't mean the U.S. has to simply give up on the idea. The U.S. still thinks that China is unlikely to perform as promised, absent very tough enforcement measures. And my view is that the U.S. is more likely to accept no agreement than to accept the immediate removal of tariffs. And that's why the talks have gone on for so long. We have two sides strongly positioned in diametric opposition on a crucial topic of discussion. Now, as I predicted here last week, I just think there's no chance for an agreement with the immediate removal of all tariffs. China may not like that, but I think that's just where we are right now.
Okay, as always, thank you very much, Brock Silvers, Kaiyun Capital's Managing Director, on our segment called Voice from China, all the way from Shanghai on Money FM 89.3.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.